Good evening. This is Steve Anderson. I'm filling in for Eva Herr on her Infinite Consciousness talk show. And this evening, we're going to interview Mr. Paul Von Ward. He considers himself an independent scholar and a cosmologist. He's got a lot of history and lots of background. He's got graduate degrees from Florida State University and from Harvard University. He was in the U.S. Foreign Service for over 15 years. He was a naval officer, a diplomat, and a nonprofit leader. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Steve. I'm delighted to be with you.
Yes, and a few books, too, that we'll tap into. Kind of in a nutshell, why don't you give us an overview of who you are and what are you about?
Well, I call myself an interdisciplinary cosmologist, and I have to explain that term because most people have not heard of interdisciplinary cosmology. They hear of people like Stephen Hawking, who is a unidisciplinary cosmologist, meaning that he looks at the cosmos only from a point of view that is known to physicists as a scientific discipline. Cosmology, by definition, means one who studies the cosmos, how all the big picture parts fit together and work together. And that means you have to study more than physics, because humans have consciousness, we have emotions, we have history of communications with other forms of consciousness in the universe. We have multidimensional experiences, which are not all physical experiences that can be studied by physics. So to be a true cosmologist, you really have to take an interdisciplinary approach, taking knowledge from all epistemologies, all sources of knowledge, and try to put the pieces of the cosmic puzzle together. So I think of myself sort of as a puzzle master trying to fill in the blanks, and I use physics, I use biology, I use anthropology, I use consciousness research, I use psychology, I use philosophical material. I try to draw from all of these disciplines to give a at least current picture of the universe as we understand it, if we look at all of our collective human areas of study and research.
Wonderful. What drew you to this scope, this gigantic scope of information?
You know, I don't know where this comes from. I think that all of us have probably, when we're born and as we begin to develop ourselves, we have our own unique take on, you know, how to look at reality. And different people have different ways of viewing things. And I always, from a very early age, somehow had a tendency to think about the big picture. People would talk to me about, you know, one subject, and I would say, how does that fit into this, or how does that relate to that? And I grew up in a very strict Southern Baptist religious tradition, and yet every time I talked about the Bible and theology and the preacher's sermon and the Sunday school classes, I always had questions about, well, how does that fit into this story, which comes from another part of the world? And so it's been something that I've done all my life. And of course, in your early days of education and acculturation, you know, you take in sort of people around you offer, and your scope is somewhat limited. But as we progress through different levels of education, different levels of experience, if we keep our eyes open, if we keep our minds open, then we expand to take in a lot of other worldviews, a lot of other cultures, a lot of other belief systems. And my life has been fortunate enough I have been fortunate in my life to have so many opportunities like that. I started out in a little town in northwest Florida, in a very rural setting, as I say, in a very fundamentalist, traditional Protestant culture, and went off to college and went off to graduate school, expanding all the way. met very early on in college Paul Tillich, one of the greatest Protestant theologians in history, who just blew my mind with his expanded views of religion and theology and so on. Then, you know, I left graduate school, went into the Navy, and spent time in that culture, meeting people from other countries and other military services. And then I went into the Foreign Service, and, you know, 100 countries later, I had been exposed to many, many cultural views, many, many perceptions of reality. And then somewhere along the way, I just began to study more and more although I primarily was focusing on the field of psychology in my graduate work, I expanded it into politics and history and economics and physics and statistics and how to put all these things together. So I can't help but take any given experience and begin to wonder how it relates to the bigger picture. For example, I'm part of a group that's right now receiving messages from an advanced being that calls himself Yeshua or Jesus, speaking through a person who is a channel who writes down what this being says to him. And when I have received that information and I read it and I think about it, I realize that I've got on my shelves in my study, you know, 3 or 4 books that have been channeled by a being named Jesus. And I wonder, you know, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
There are different messages, there are different personalities coming through. And then I raise the question, well, how about the human who's translating this? What difference does it make depending on the personality and the beliefs and the experience of that human channel? So everything that I study in this effort to understand all the aspects, the multidimensionality of our human experience, I can't help but want to synthesize new information with information that I have from other sources. And this is my process, and that's what I have in the book Our Solarian Legacy, Multidimensional Humans in a Self-Learning Universe. That's really my cosmology of about 5 or 6 years ago.
Well, I have about 10 questions out of that last.
Good. I love questions.
I need to get in the one question that Eva always likes to ask is, did you have an opening? Did you have an elevation of consciousness at one point in your life, or has it been an educational process, or what's your take on that?
Well, I can't say that I have had an epiphany as Paul did on the road to Damascus or other such significant personal events that a lot of people refer to when they talk about the moment during which or after which they open their minds to different levels of reality and to different ways of knowing. I have had a lot of those experiences over the years of varying degrees in many places in the world. I spent the night in the king's chamber in the pyramid at Giza many, many years ago. Phenomenal inner journeys and experiences in that event. I've awakened in the desert at Timbuktu in the starry sky of that ancient place with visions of things past. I've had so many of these things that I consider them to be normal. And I think that I have always been more open. I've never been totally attached to the belief of the moment or to the belief that I had accumulated based on a particular course of study or a particular exposure to one culture or the other, one religion or the other. I look at religions. I was a youthful minister ordained when I was in graduate school and had a church and ministered to that congregation, and have over the years served as sort of a spiritual mentor to a number of people, and in many, many instances over the years carried out a what might be called a ministerial role with rituals and marriages and funerals and other such rites of passage in our society. But I'm never closed in by any one of those experiences or institutions. When I look at all the religions in the world, for example, I'm a believer in none of them, and I accept all of them mm-hmm. as they represent a cultural perspective of a different part of the species that we call Homo sapiens. And I look for the common threads in them. I look for the beliefs that can be found consistent with what we learn from our scientific explorations and research. So, you know, that's the way I function.
Got it. Great. So are there a few, can you highlight a few of the common threads that you see in the different worldviews and the different religions? How would you put them all together? What seems to fit with many of them?
Well, the first thing, and that's the subtitle of this book, I called the subtitle Multidimensional Humans in a Self-Learning Universe. Multidimensional Humans. One thing that is common among all of the religious cultures and is now becoming more and more common in the scientific community as we are emerging, and I'll talk about that a little bit later in terms of the scientific communities emerging into a multidimensional perspective of the universe and from a simple three-dimensional or four-dimensional material sort of perspective. But among all religions, there is this understanding that humans are more than the physical form that we are, and that there are connections between all of us, among all of us, and between these dimensions. In other words, that I, as a being, have an aspect or a part of me that transcends physical space and time, and that that is a more permanent aspect of me than my physical incarnation. So this is something that's common to all mm-hmm. of the major religions. Also, there's a sense that in these religions that there is a set of principles or patterns or laws, we use different terms for them, but that there is a set of criteria by which humans ought to live their lives in order to fully realize our potential and in order to fully be of service to one another and in order to take advantage of the life that we have and so on. Now, these principles come from different sources, you know. The Jewish tradition and the Christian tradition said, well, you know, Yahweh gave them to Moses behind the burning bush
mm-hmm.
And then commanded that they be transcribed on the tablets of stone and given to the children on their way to Canaan. So that's the source there. The Muslims, you know, say, well, Gabriel appeared to Mohammed and dictated these rules and patterns and ways that we ought to live to humanity through that channel. The Mormon Church says, you know, Moroni appeared to Joseph Smith and told him where to get the tablets that would result in this new religion. So all of these religious perspectives, when you go back to the Hindu perspective, and you have Saraswati, who gave writing to the ancient Hindu people and the other advanced beings who communicated to the Hindu people about these rules and patterns and the way the universe works. So you all of them have this common thread that humans are in contact and in communication with beings more advanced than we are that give us some helpful guidance and so on. Now, some people make more of it than others, and some of them, some religious groups, and particularly the fundamentalists in all the religions, come to believe that they've got the only set of wisdom from their particular source. They are unwilling to consider that all of these groups have been in contact and communication with other beings and have similar information. And so those are the fundamentalists, but the people who are more ecumenical in their perspective, who are willing to take in all of these different views, know that this is something in common. So this is a common human experience. And now we, of course, have a lot of scientists working on documenting communications like this. One of the things that I mentioned earlier about this person that's a friend of mine who is receiving this information allegedly from a being named Yeshua. I am participating in this, and others are, studying this process, trying to understand it, looking at the information that comes from it, and comparing it to other sources of information so that we can learn what the universal kernel of truth is in this as we begin to filter out the biases of the worldview of the channel, as we begin to filter out our own biases, you know, and our own beliefs, to see what's really being said there that is consistent with what we know about science, what we know about religion, what we know about the consciousness of humans and other beings who seem to also have consciousness somewhat like ours that we communicate with.
Got it. This brings up the question for me, what's your viewpoint on, you're mentioning beings that have that are more advanced on the other side versus one source. Is there one source, or are there just these advanced beings? What's your take on that?
Well, my take on it is that all beings, whether you call them Yahweh or Gabriel or Krishna or Hermes or Thoth in Egypt, or Rantha, the being that J.G. Knight speaks to, or Atun Re, a being that is channeled through a guy named Kevin Larson. All of these, the reason I use the term ABs or advanced beings, they're all more advanced than humans to the extent that they can initiate communications with us, but we can't force them to communicate with us. It's sort of like you, if you're in the military service and you know that there are some admirals and generals up there, and they're off in their office, and you can't really communicate to them unless they're willing to give you some of their time and attention and presence. And so, you know, we consider them to be higher than us in rank, and we consider them to be more advanced than us, and they have more power and control. Well, the universe has many different species, many different levels of beings, of consciousness, all of which, as far as I'm concerned, are evolving beings in their own little corner of the universe. And they are doing their own development work on themselves and in their corner of the universe, and some of them share information with us, some of them don't want to share information with us. The ones that we hear from, of course, are willing to have communication with us, but there are many who don't communicate with us. So what we as humans have to do is to try to get as much information as we can from as many different sources and try to put it together and say, what does this tell us about our universe? And that's what a cosmologist does.
Okay.
As far as the source...
The source, yes.
I think the source is an unknown force from which the universe was manifest. I call it the yin-yang force, that is the positive, negative, male, female, active, passive. To create anything, you have to have this interaction between the yin and the yang. So if we have a universe which is created at some level by some force and some intention, but I think that that ultimate source is manifest through the principles of nature, through the way we live and breathe and learn and grow and evolve and so on. But from my own point of view, it's a self-learning universe. In other words, the creator, whatever that force is, manifests itself in this universe of ours as an experiment, learning its own potential. And we as manifestations, as individual organisms in that larger organism, are all part of this self-learning organism. That is, we are figuring out how we can function together with other species, with planetary systems, with galactic systems, how we can use our consciousness to continually expand it and our capacities, our skills, our talents, and develop them in an open-ended way to see what this universe will become. In my view, in a philosophical sort of way, I think it's an open-ended universe, and we're part of that process. And we should not take, just as you in the Navy or I in the Navy or someone else in the Army would never say the five-star general is the end-all and be-all of wisdom and knowledge just because he is more senior in rank and more advanced in education than I am. And so we should never, as humans, as a species and as individuals, never look to one of these sources as being the end-all and be-all, because they are all finite in their own ways, and they represent their mm-hmm. own worldview, their own experience, their own perspective, their own agenda.
But also, I'm also hearing, though, that there is this infinite intelligence that with some intention it created all this.
Well, but see, that is the most precise that I think I could go. I say the intention is there, and how do we know what that intention is? I say, and this is what I try to do in this book and in other books that I work on and talks and papers that I do. The only way we can know that intention is to learn it through the experience of the universe that we can touch and feel and interact with and intuit and infer from. In other words, our information is really the only information we have is through our own experience of that universe. And you see, what happens is when we run into an advanced, a being more advanced than we are, we like to stop there and say, oh, that being has got it figured out. Or that particular message mm-hmm. is the ultimate message. And what I'm suggesting is that no, what's important for us to understand is that we all have messages. We all have our views of where we are and how things work. And we have to keep testing it for ourselves. We have to keep trying to see where that envelope can be pushed, where that skill, where that knowledge in healing, for example, we have to continually expand our knowledge by trial and error and research and testing, and that applies to healing with drugs. It applies to healing with lifestyles. It applies to healing with our own conscious intentions. It refers to healing in terms of interacting with one another in prayer groups or meditation groups or intentional communities. In other words, everything that we do is a continual evolving and expanding of our conscious awareness. And I think we're so far from having the ultimate cosmic experience that we escape our responsibility to continue to learn and grow when we settle on the answer.
Right, and also the challenge is we're testing through our senses, which is really through our own belief system, our own rose-colored glasses, and that's the illusionary state because we start trusting our senses.
See,
but the guy next to us has a whole different set of senses.
Yeah, but see, I don't like the word illusion. Illusion, to use that term, it sort of has a connotation of unreality. And what I'm suggesting is that what we have, and this goes back to one of my old sermon days, to see through a glass darkly, that phrase implies that our vision will always be colored by the glass through which we look at any experience, whether
mm-hmm.
it's our inner glasses or our outer glasses. The same thing happens when we have an awakening experience in terms of our inner ways of knowing. The same thing happens as with our external ways of knowing. Because we, in the core of our core, interpret all of those experiences.
Right.
And so what we're doing is continually taking in information and processing it and comparing it to other information, and we're slowly building a greater scope of awareness, a greater perspective that brings more and more of reality into our field of conscious awareness. And to me, this is the process. In other words, we are, as individuals, continually expanding our scope of awareness as we open ourselves to new knowledge and learning. And the fundamentalist scientist who is stuck on the standard model of physics
mm-hmm.
is pretty well stuck. He is not open to what's happening now in research on consciousness, research on biofields, research on the energy and information fields that seem to have even more influence in the universe than the matter and energy of, Einstein's great formula. So the standard physicist is in the same box that the fundamentalist Christian,
mm-hmm.
and the fundamentalist Muslim, and the fundamentalist, you name it, is in, because he or she is stuck on a set of data that's limited and is unwilling to look at new information as it comes over the horizon. And so we have a dilemma here too, because we can't be open to everything at the same time. So we have to make choices, We have to say, okay, this period of my life, I'm going to look at this area. And maybe next year I can look at this. And maybe 2 years from now I can look at that. And that's a reasonable position to take, because there's so much research going on. There's so much so-called spiritual information. There's so much called what's called new science. There's so much channel material. There's so much scientific research. None of us can, you know, cope with all of that. So we have to learn to be discerning, and we have to learn to set some priorities. But the operative point here is we have to continue to be open to contrary evidence to the belief that we hold today.
But what's your operational definition of being open? Because somebody, I mean, there's probably a fundamentalist cosmologist out there that just, you know, I'm looking at everything and this is the way it is from my perspective.
The human condition, excuse me, I was talking so much here without
taking a sip.
A sip of tea. The human condition is that we are not alone. We tend to think of ourselves as alone, but we really are a member of a species. You know, the fact that we are part of a species means that we have to grow as a species. We have to learn as a species. And this requires that we try to, as we have individual ideas, new ideas, old ideas, we need to test them with other people who are different from us. And only when we are willing to engage in this cross-cultural, multidisciplinary examination, will we actually make any progress. And so the people who are stuck in their own view and are not willing to talk to me about mine and talk to you about yours and test their own views against each other, that person has reached a cul-de-sac. That person is not going to develop any further in this particular lifetime. And they might as well check out and, you know, move on. But they frequently don't do that. We stay around because there's a possibility of learning at another point in time from an experience we have or something happens to us that changes our mind.
Got it. Let's talk a little bit about when you first opened up and you were talking about channeling and that's being filtered through the person who's channeling, and religions are being filtered through the person who had the epiphany. What's the discernment there? How do you distinguish what is real and what is just the misperceptions through the filter system of the person who is having the epiphany?
Well, this is I've used the term, you know, being an intelligence officer, and I don't claim to be an intelligence officer myself in terms of any real professional sense, but I've had enough experience in the military and in the diplomatic service and the foreign service with CIA colleagues and military intelligence colleagues and so on, to recognize that there is something of value in the process that an intelligence officer uses in looking at evidence and information that he or she needs to study in order to come to some sort of consensus about. And that is, you have to look at all of the sources and methods involved. And you know, the CIA says we won't tell the Congress our sources and methods because we might damage our spy networks. Well, that's only half the reason. The other half is, if you tell your sources and methods to the Congress would realize that, well, you don't have a very strong case. So we in this business of looking at spirituality, looking at religion, looking at inner senses, looking at consciousness, we too have to force ourselves to follow the intelligence officer's concern. And so we need to look at the three things that you mentioned. What is the source? You know, what mm-hmm. is the interpreter? And what is your own perception? So there are really three levels there. And you have to recognize that the source, whether it's Yahweh or Gabriel or Jesus or Ramtha or Krishna or whomever, there's an agenda. That being has its own objectives, priorities, purposes. Why are they passing that information on to us? That's the first question we should ask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why does Jesus keep coming back, speaking to different people through these channels, trying to get across a message? That's because that being has an ego need to teach and preach because it thinks that it has a good idea, a way to help humans improve their condition, improve human culture on the planet, improve their interaction with other beings and other dimensions. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I write books, so I have an agenda. My agenda is to share my ideas with others and to hope that some people will take them seriously and so on. So whoever you are, whether you're a Paul von Ward or whether you're a Jesus or whether you're a Yahweh or whether you are Ramtha, whether you are Mike Huckabee, whether you are George Bush, and so on, we all have our agendas, we all have our objectives, and we're sharing our information and we're trying to convince people that we've got some good ideas and so on. But you listening to me, you say, well, now what's Paul trying to do? What's Jesus trying to do? What's Yahweh trying to do? What is their objective? And then, of course, you're looking at it through your own experience, so you've got your slant on it, which is the interpreter's slant. And you start telling me what you heard, and then there's my own perception. So what I'm trying to do is to bring all of this stuff down to a real mundane daily level. A lot of people who have experiences of having interactions with other beings or having other voices or having information from other sources, just because it's non-human, there's a tendency to think it's perfect, to think it represents mm-hmm. the ultimate. And what I'm trying to do is to demystify all of that and say, no, you know, it's just another part of the picture. It helps us to get a bigger sense of what's going on. It helps us to understand ourselves better and our larger potential, which is great. That's what a teacher does to the students. But ultimately, the students have to decide what they're going to do with what the teacher says. Because if you don't go through a process of questioning and making up your own mind based on a lot of evidence, then you simply become a member of a cult of a particular teacher, a particular proselytizer. A proselytizer is one who tries to get other people to form a group to believe or act in a certain way. And all of these beings, to one degree or the other, are trying to do that. I make the analogy to my experience in foreign service and traveling around to 100 countries. I've seen advanced beings and forms of humans from the United States and France and Germany and Japan and so on go into Africa and South America and Southeast Asia and go in with power and knowledge and so on that makes them advanced beings to the local people. And the local people have a choice. They have a choice of becoming dependent on, bowing to, kissing the hand of these more advanced humans are taking what they have to say and then making up their own mind what to do with it and sorting out their own lives. And humans, as a species, need to do the same thing with other beings, whether they're angels or ETs or gods or spirit guides or whatever. You know, we have the responsibility to keep it in perspective.
Got it. We're getting kind of close to the end, so I want you to come back to how you're feeling, your feelings about the scientific community finally merging in matters of consciousness and matter and energy.
Well, this is what's the most fascinating thing that's happening in society today from my point of view. Finally, science is getting around to the point where it is willing to examine that which is not purely physical. And it's coming from a number of different directions in science. Because, see, science, just as we mystify religion and spirituality, you know, make it into something more than it is, we do the same thing with science. You know, we make it as something very special, mm-hmm. and this is the only way to find out the real truth of the universe, et cetera, et cetera. And the reality is that all of these, science and religion and spirituality and natural philosophy, are all ways of approaching the same subject from a little different direction. And so by science now becoming open to look at things like near-death experiences, to look at things like telepathy or psychokinesis, or to even address the question of reincarnation, which I've been doing in my book that's coming out next month called The Soul Genome, Science and Reincarnation. I'm looking at it and bringing in what science is bringing to this question. So, what's happening is from different disciplines, science is now beginning to deal with consciousness, to deal with subtle energies, to deal with dimensions that connect us to one another and to the universe as a whole that are not physical. And this is coming out of several disciplines. Out of physics, you have the notion of non-locality, mm-hmm. which means that everything is connected to everything else, and something being done in this part of the universe affects something in another part of the universe. There's also the concept of entanglement, that is, that activities and organisms in this particular location, through these energetic fields, are entangled with and influencing and being influenced by each other. And so those kinds of ideas are coming out of physics, that there is a quantum plenum of some energetic plasma, some field, that may be conterminous with, that is, the same as universal consciousness. And there are physicists like Hal Puthoff and the late Suiji Inamata from Japan, John A. Wheeler, mainstream physicist, but who now is thinking along these lines, a physicist mm-hmm. in Switzerland, André Morand, who is also thinking in these term. So a lot of physicists are beginning to realize if you're going to talk about string theory and multidimensional universes, then you're going to be dealing with things that we, up to this point, called paranormal and outside of the normal realm of science. Well, it's being brought in by the physicist. It's also being brought in by the biologist. The biologists are understanding more and more that what happens from an old cell dying to a new cell taking its place, from an old human dying or a monarch butterfly or a fruit fly or some other species, that there's something going on, that there's information that is more than just the proteins and the DNA patterns in our genome involved. There are now a number of studies that show that things that are not reflected in our genome and in our DNA in fact seem to be controlling what happens to the DNA and the way it either adapts and evolves and mutates, or it doesn't. There's a concept known as epigenetics in biology, which implies that there is some sort of information field that seems to determine whether certain genes will be turned off or on.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not within the physical genome itself. There's an information field there. I just reviewed a book called Mind and Life, which was put together by about 15 scientists a year or so ago, on a number of studies showing the necessity of this sort of bioenergetic field, which is not physical, which actually is controlling the life functions of a species, including us as humans. So this is coming out of biology, out of chemistry. It's coming out of the research that a number of people are doing. I just read an article this week, which was published in January in a physics journal, indicating that there seems to be some sort of telepathic connection between strands of DNA.
Hmm.
Another study came out back in the fall of last year, a few months ago, with chemists working with dust particles from space and realizing that as they stirred these particles up, they began to reform themselves in zero gravity in a way that was in the shape of a helix, which of course is the same shape that our DNA
forms.
And these are dust particles in space. And they seem to pass that memory on. So, anyhow, I could go on and on about...
Oh, it's fascinating and exciting.
These kinds of things that are happening in the various disciplines of science that are now beginning to come around to touch on the same kinds of things that we've talked about in religion and spiritual groups and so on. Now, what's fascinating to me about this is you see, the religious folks and the spiritual folks are now, some of them are saying, we need this kind of science to happen, but when it happens, it demystifies their beliefs. It makes it clear that what's going on here is a natural process of multidimensionality, of consciousness working throughout all of the facets of the universe. And you don't have this sort of divine manipulation, you know, special case thing that people in religious groups feel like, you know, well, I've got a special case. My messenger is the one. What science is now saying is, no. Excuse me. This happens everywhere. So for someone like myself who has a view that I call natural spirituality, meaning that it's not connected to any one particular divine being or divine theology or spiritual concept, but that it's inherent in nature. And this is going back to where the Greeks were, you know, over 2,000 years ago. It's also going back to where a guy named Giordano Bruno, a Catholic priest in the 16th century, who was burned at the stake in 1600, his sin, as far as the church was concerned, was he wrote a natural cosmology. And believe it or not, it's somewhat like my cosmology, our Solarian legacy.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know it until after I wrote mine, and a friend read the book and said, well, let me give you this book written by a guy back in the 16th century. And it's the same thing.
Perfect.
You know, multidimensional, interactive, all of this natural processes, this set of natural processes that work at different levels. It's a very modern cosmology written 500 years ago. And then if you want to go back, of course, even further to Thoth and Egypt and Hermes and Greece, you have the same, the Hermetic principles, for example, which are very, and I used that and I elaborated on it in the book, Our Solarian Legacy, because it's a cosmology that's very compatible with what we're now seeing emerging from these various fields of science.
Paul, we only have a couple minutes. It sounds like if we had to start out with one of your books, it would be Our Solarian Legacy. Is that where we need to start, or what would you suggest?
Well, they're a little bit different. Our Solarian Legacy is the big picture, the cosmology. I recommend that for people who are interested in this question of inner senses and subtle ways of knowing and, you know, what we call the paranormal, which is not paranormal, telepathy, the consciousness studies, the whole business of conscious intent and the power of intent. All of that is treated in that book.
Okay.
The book, God's Genes and Consciousness, deals with the advanced beings, the ABs, and human experience with them and how we have reacted to that. If you want to look at that problem, that's the book.
Okay.
And, of course, the new one, it's not going to be out until sometime in March, but make a note of it. And
that's next month.
Report in March is called The Soul Genome, Science and Reincarnation. And it looks at reincarnation the same way we've been talking about these other things. It looks at them. It looks at reincarnation as a natural process. It's the same process in terms of the preservation of human consciousness and human learning from generation to generation as we have in fruit flies, monarch butterflies, individual cells. There's something at work in all forms of life. There's a process that somehow preserves the learning, the knowledge, the awakening, the expansion of awareness, the new ways of doing things, and transmits some of that to the next generation in a way that the universe doesn't lose that knowledge. That's what evolution's all about. You know, it's preserving the adaptations based on experience in a particular lifetime by a particular species, and conserving that for the next generation. And this is a natural process. And so the book, The Soul Genome, treats the whole issue of reincarnation from that perspective. And I think there's a very strong case for it. The evidence is quite strong that I set out in that book, that what we're talking about is really a natural process, and all of us are a part of that. Who we are, what we are, is based on the legacy we came with in this lifetime from preceding lifetimes, just the way the organisms in any species, and even as individual cells, continue to evolve and grow. So I say reincarnation is to the conservation of consciousness as the principle of the conservation of energy is to the E equals MC squared formula.
Got
in
it.
Other words, energy equals matter times the speed of light squared means you cannot destroy matter. In our energy, you can only change the form.
Mm-hmm.
The principle of reincarnation is consciousness cannot be either destroyed it can only be changed from one form to the other, and that is what happens in the process of reincarnation. Once we begin to bring science back into the realm of spirit, and spirit into the realm of science,
mm-hmm.
we're going to make a huge leap in the human species. We will leave behind materialistic science, and we will leave behind fundamentalist religion. Those worldviews will be left in the history, the dustbin of history, because once we get the two lens together on the same issues, the same questions, the same subjects, that's when we're going to have a real awakening, a species awakening. What you were talking about earlier is, you know, a partial awakening by an individual.
Mm-hmm.
That's only, you know, sort of peeking a bit more from your eye.
Okay, Paul, we just have a few seconds. Give us your webpage.
The website is easy to remember. It's just www.vonward.com. V like in Victor, O-N-W-A-R-D.com.
Great.
Website.
Thank you for this wonderful interview. And I want to thank Eva Herr for letting me sit in on her Infinite Consciousness this evening. This is Steve Anderson in San Diego, and I wish you all well. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. Good night.